Now, God forbid we should have a group argument. We just talked about group meetings. But if you don't have anything more, I mean, I'm sure you have more to add, but it's a similar argument to what, excellent argument that Ms. Robertson made. It's okay. I'm just saying, you've heard this argument.
You have the full time, however.
And your client may have separate interests, which you want to advocate here. Okay.
Your Honor just pointed out one of the hugest difficulties in this case. David and Natalie are not the same people.
Yep.
They deserve separate arguments. They are individual people.
Sure.
And that's what counsel did not recognize in this case. So we are here today because the respondent wants you to affirm the decision of the motion court, which was to deny post-conviction relief to David without an evidentiary hearing. So I'm like, well, what exactly does that mean? So I went back to Blacks. To affirm a judgment is to, according to Blacks, in the practice of appellate courts, to affirm a judgment, decree, or order is to declare that it is valid and right and must stand as rendered to below, to ratify and reassert it, to concur in its correctness and confirm its efficacy. Is that what this court really wants to do with the motion court's decision? Let's start off with the first problem, the group guilty plea. This is a practice that this court condemned in Wright versus State. Pardon me for quoting your own words.
That's good. That's helpful.
We have stated repeatedly that it should be discontinued. That decision was in 2013. That's the same year that David and Natalie pled guilty. So obviously, the motion court, which was the same court that heard the plea, totally ignored what this court was saying about group guilty pleas. But the respondent wants you to affirm the motion court's decision that it was okay for counsel not to object to the group guilty plea. So the second problem that we have that my colleague discussed more was the conflict of interest. So what was the basis for the conflict of interest? Okay. Which was not gone into as much. The fact that David and Natalie were charged with the same offenses. Now, I filed the transcript of the second suppression hearing so that you could understand what exactly the plea court knew before it heard the pleas. It knew that the police had found the marijuana in David's bathtub, not in his condo's bathtub, but in the bathtub off the master suite where he slept. It also found the mature marijuana plants in his bedroom closet. Differing levels of culpability. Yeah, I would say so. The other is that they were siblings, of course, and that they received a contingent offer from the state.
Did you report counsel for discipline when you reviewed this record?
No, I did not. I feel that's the court's decision. The problem with the contingent offer, and it's also sort of who's doing the... I have a problem with the state making a contingent offer more than I have them with plea counsel being stuck with a contingent offer.
Did you report the state for doing that?
No, I did not.
Do you have a responsibility to do so?
I did move to disqualify the prosecuting attorney from the case, and that motion was denied.
Well, if you see a violation of the rules, do you have a responsibility to report the violation of the rules to the disciplinary authorities?
Since there is a disagreement about whether there's an actual conflict of interest, the respondent takes the opposite position. I don't know.
It will depend on the outcome of this case, you're saying?
Yes.
And here the actual conflict showed itself in what ways?
I think it became a problem the minute plea counsel reviewed the police reports and saw that David was much more culpable than Natalie, which I don't know if that was before or after he had them sign the waiver.
And the waiver was you attacked the adequacy of the waiver also?
The
description of what a conflict is?
I would say that the waiver was not complete.
Have you reviewed the waiver? Is it in the record?
Yes, yes.
Is it in the record?
The waiver is attached. It's in the legal file, yes. The waiver says, and if I find that there's an actual conflict of interest, I'll let you know and we'll deal with it then. Well, to me, that's not a complete waiver because he says, well, right now it's not an actual conflict of interest, but if one develops, I'll let you know. That's not a complete explanation.
It doesn't give sufficient information for them to understand
not
what
at all.
Waiving.
Not at all, Your Honor. And the other problem I have with the conflict of interest is that it doesn't, with the waiver form, sorry, is that it doesn't explain that it is still the court's responsibility to guarantee conflict-free counsel. And it is also the attorney's ethical obligation, as my colleague mentioned, it is still the attorney's obligation to watch out for conflicts of interest. The lead case in this area is the State X. Rel. Horn case that everybody's been citing. And I find it interesting that it comes out of the same jurisdiction that Natalie and David's case does. It's a case, of course, in which the defense attorney was representing both the defendant and the complaining witness in an unrelated case, which is about the problem we have here. The other thing that the respondent asks this court to affirm is the motion court's deciding that it was okay for the courtroom to be closed to the public. The courtroom in which David pled and was sentenced was closed to the public. When I raised that issue before the motion court and I got findings back, I was expecting a one-sentence finding. The claim is refuted by the record because the courtroom was open to the public, period. That's not the response I got from the motion court. I got 2 pages of findings on that issue alone explaining why it's okay to close a courtroom in certain circumstances. So that's telling me that the motion court is not denying that the courtroom was closed to the public, especially because none of its exceptions applied in this particular case, and some of it was just misstatements of the law.
Did you report that to the authorities that the closing the court?
Actually, the Arch City defenders have been doing a good job of reporting closed courtrooms to the Missouri legislature, and they also, of course, the problem though was municipal courts, not state courts. But
not,
I think
it would be the commission on removal of district judges if they close the courtroom when they're not supposed to.
I would agree with that, because but David's family and friends were not allowed to be in the courtroom when he was sentenced to 22 years.
Focusing on the facts here, though, and why they would entitle your client to relief, from what you said so far, your client was the more guilty.
Yes.
You're alleging he was prejudiced because he got a great deal up front that he didn't take because they required his sister to also take a plea at the time? Or what is the prejudice here that you're alleging?
I can't tell from the record that the initial 10-year with 559 offer was contingent. I'm not seeing that from the record. From the plea offer that counsel received from the state, it doesn't say that both have to plead. The state didn't come up with this contingent requirement until I think like the day before the people actually pled, or it could have been the day of, when it finally dawned on the prosecutor that he might have this problem. Mm-hmm. So the initial offer of 10 years, the problem that David had, that 10-year offer is the best he ever heard from the state. And it's also the standard offer for cultivation cases in St. Francis County. And that's why he should have been able to take it.
And why did the conflict prevent him from doing so?
Because it wasn't, because David did not understand that he had to choose between the suppression issue and accepting the plea deal. Because one of the conditions of the prosecutor's offer, of that 10-year offer, was that David not file any suppression motions, not file any hearings, notices of hearing on the suppression motions, or not depose any witnesses. And David was not advised of that.
What does that have to do with the conflict and Natalie?
Because it was in Natalie's best interest, Judge Wilson, to litigate the suppression issue.
If it was a contingent,
no.
Then what about his plea deal would have prevented her from going forward and litigating it?
I'm sorry, can you repeat the question?
We're talking about the first offer, right?
Yes.
And you say it wasn't contingent.
It was not contingent, as I understand it.
Okay, so what about David's plea would have prevented Natalie from going forward and litigating her own motion to suppress?
Because the court had the preliminary hearing and the first suppression hearing. It was all the same hearing for David and Natalie. It was all bundled together. So Natalie's suppression hearing was the same as David's suppression hearing. It was not a separate hearing.
At the associate circuit level.
At the associate level and at the circuit court level.
So you're saying neither of them could litigate it. That was a condition of the plea. Neither of them could have a suppression hearing.
Assuming that Natalie had the same conditions, I don't know. David definitely did.
So yeah. You represent David.
Yes.
So David got a better deal. Why are you objecting to it? If he got a better deal than he would have gotten otherwise,
he didn't.
By pleading with Natalie, where's the prejudice?
Judge Teitelman, he got no deal.
He what?
He pled open.
He got no deal.
He got at his sentencing, the state asked for the maximum number on each sentence to run consecutively, and the judge ran two out of the three consecutive and gave him the max on each sentence.
And as I recall now, you said the conflict was that he did that so that the prosecutor would withdraw the charge of bad check charge and another charge against his sister in return for that. So he made those contingent on each other, and therefore he pled open with no deal so that those charges would be withdrawn against her.
Précisément. That's where the group guilty plea is the real problem here, because picture what's going on at this group guilty plea. They're hurting so many people in front of the judge. They can't even stand in a straight line in front of the judge. They can't even stand in a semicircle. They're standing in a horseshoe in front of their judge. There are so many people pleading before the judge that their own attorneys can't stand next to them. David and Natalie pled guilty without their attorney standing next to them. David and Natalie pled guilty shoulder to shoulder. And the motion court said that was okay. And I say it's not. David shouldn't have had to be under that level of coercion when he pled guilty, just because he wanted to help out his sister. The other thing that the state is asking you to affirm is that the counsel's failure to advise David of the full conditions of the offer, that he had to choose between the litigation issue and the litigating the suppression issue and accepting the guilty plea offer.
Your time is up.
Oh, I beg
your
pardon.
Thank you.
May it please the court.
Sure.
This court did not condemn group guilty pleas in State versus Wright. The Wright case was decided by the Eastern District, which has, up through yesterday, by its own characterization, conducted some sort of assault on group guilty pleas. The court decided a case yesterday and described its previous decisions as an assault on this procedure. It was in Wright that the court made that statement, the Court of Appeals, but ultimately determined that the defendant's guilty plea was not invalid, even though it was taken during a group guilty plea. It was
so should we amend our rule, require all pleas to be in groups?
Well, whether that would be an appropriate amendment is, I think, something for the court to consider under the federal rules. When there's dual jurisdiction or dual representation, I believe the court is required to inquire. But our rule 2402 does not require that. That's something that the federal rules do, and that would be something for this court to consider. And I don't think it would be inappropriate for the court to consider that. And I do think that it would have the potential of clearing up potential conflicts of interest and perhaps bringing to light actual conflicts that need to be resolved. But in Roberts, this court, absent anything in the rule, certainly, in Roberts, the court said, we are not persuaded that a group guilty plea automatically renders a guilty plea invalid, or the procedure itself is per se invalid. And that was what the motion court relied on in finding that there wasn't a basis for counsel to object, because the claim raised by the by Mr. DePriest, by the appellant in this case, is not that the trial court conducted an improper procedure, but that counsel was ineffective for failing to object to that procedure, which brings this claim under the rubric of Strickland, generally, at least. Now that I should say Strickland and Hill, which means that you have to show first that counsel's performance fell below an objective standard of reasonableness, and also that there was prejudice in the case, meaning under Hill that but for counsel's alleged error, the defendant would not have pleaded guilty and would have insisted on going to trial. Now, the defendant's allegations in this case fell far short of alleging Strickland prejudice or even a violation of the Strickland standard by counsel. Counsel didn't have any reason to believe, at least as far as I can tell from the allegations in the amended motion, that this defendant did not understand the proceedings, that this defendant went in with an inability to understand what was happening. Maybe the defendant even knew it was going to be a group plea. We can't tell from the pleadings that the defendant entered into these circumstances with anything less than full advice about what was about to occur. And it should be presumed, absent allegations to the contrary, that counsel adequately advised the defendant about what was going to happen. But here's the other point. When the plea court started up the procedure, the court took time and said, look, I'm going to do this way because, frankly, it saves time. But you need to understand that there are important questions coming your way. I need to make sure that your plea is knowing, intelligent, voluntary. I need to make sure you understand certain rights. If there's something you don't understand, stop me. Ask.
And that was not done, was it?
Pardon me?
That wasn't done where the judge would inquire individually regarding their understanding of the plea they're taking.
I think it was done. The judge asked each defendant about his or her individual case at various points. The judge even stopped, and for instance, in laying a factual basis, and inquired of each defendant individually and said, tell me what you did, and took time. Now, there were some questions that I think lent themselves to asking down the line. And the judge said, do you understand, for instance, that by pleading guilty, you will not have a trial? It's pretty easy to understand that, and all of the defendants indicated down the line, yes, I understand that by pleading guilty, I'm giving up that right. I don't think the fact that there were six people that said it along with the defendant changes the fact the defendant also understood. We should be able to rely on the defendant's testimony unless and until the defendant alleges facts showing that he didn't understand and that what he was really doing was just parroting the questions of the other defendants. But there wasn't a single allegation in the amended motion that this defendant fell victim to that potential pitfall that courts have identified with regard to group pleas.
Setting aside the group plea issue, if there was an actual conflict that would require us to remand for a hearing in Natalie's case, how could that same actual conflict not require at least the same remedy for David?
Well, I think because the defendants are two different individuals and have different interests, and because if there is an actual conflict and counsel is serving one interest to the expense of the other, it may be that the conflict of interest only gives rise to a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel as to one.
And don't you need to explore that in a hearing?
Well, if there were adequate allegations showing that counsel's performance actually fell short with regard to one of these defendants, I would say yes. I think that what it boils down to here is the same situation, I think, or a similar problem to what we had in the other case. In this case, the allegations of the amended motion, I'll grant, are extensive, and they lay out a procedural history of the case and various potential conflicts that could have arisen along the way.
But the procedures do not prescribe having group pleas. I mean, the group, it's thought, I assume it's supposed to be something where the judge asks the individual, do you understand this? And there's a focus on that plea by the individual, not that a group. Nothing in the procedures prescribe group pleas.
I would also say that nothing in the procedure prohibits a group plea. And no Missouri court has ever said that you can't have a group plea. But the rule does say the defendant has to be personally addressed. Now, what that means, whether that would be interpreted to mean that you could only do one plea at a time, I guess would be something for the court to look at. But the court has never interpreted it to mean, pardon me, that only one defendant can plead guilty in at a given time.
But that's what we could decide today.
That could be an issue here, although I don't think it's an issue that should be decided necessarily with regard to this defendant, because the question here isn't necessarily whether the court employed an improper procedure, but whether counsel had a should have known that he needed to object and that the defendant was prejudiced. But the defendant never alleged here that, you know, but for this group plea proceeding, he wouldn't have pleaded guilty. Now, if you look with relation to that, one final point, and then I'll get back to the other question I was answering, is that, you know, the defendant pleaded guilty and obviously wanted to assist his sister, because the benefit he got under this joint plea agreement was that his sister would have charges dismissed in this case, namely the gun charge, would have charges dismissed or not filed in another case relating to bad checks, and that her bond would be reinstated and she'd be released.
And didn't he need to have independent counsel from his sister to make that decision? And then if he had, he might have made it, but he had the same counsel as his sister had. How can that not be a conflict for that?
If counsel did not advise him about that,
didn't have independent counsel, and she didn't have independent counsel.
I'm not sure that that it has to be independent. What we have to have, what Mr. DePriest needed to receive from his attorney, was advice along those lines about what he was doing, and telling him, look, this is not in your interest.
When there's an actual conflict, to help your sister. Just advising him, you can still advise both?
I think he can advise him, because here's the point. It's not that, and I think if you look at Mickens versus Taylor, it's not that a conflict exists that is enough to get relief. What matters is that the conflict both exists and that the defense attorney thereby failed to do something that the attorney otherwise should have done for that client. Now, if Mr. DePriest's attorney told him and said, this plea offer doesn't help you, which I think was self-evident with regard to his charges because he was pleading open, but if counsel said, this doesn't help you and really just benefits your sister, which again I think was self-evident, but if counsel said that, and if counsel was above board and gave Mr. DePriest all of that advice, then the conflict of interest that existed between serving the interests of the sister, which were obviously served by that plea.
Well, not necessarily, because she had a good chance of getting off entirely on the underlying charge.
Well, but that's a different. That's,
she may or may not have.
She was harmed is separate from whether he was harmed.
Well, does that
he needs to show that his attorney.
You're saying it benefits her, and you're saying that's a different issue we don't need to get into. So
no,
you can't do both.
Pardon me, Your Honor. I thought you were suggesting a way she was harmed. Or could have been harmed.
Well, she might have been.
Right. Yeah. And to the extent that your question rolls over into whether Ms. DePriest was harmed,
well, but
that's a separate question of whether counsel had a conflict with regard to Mr.
You were saying
Mr.
clearly
DePriest.
It was to her benefit, and I'm saying we can't make that assumption.
Was that
all I was saying.
That's my point, too. We can't make the assumptions in this case because we need to know what their interests were, but at no point in the amended motion are those interests ever elucidated.
Waiver of conflict adequate? Your opposing counsel described the waiver of conflict. It didn't seem very specific or to address the issues that might be needed if you're going to have a real waiver of conflict. Maybe something comes up, then there's a waiver of conflict. Do you think that waiver of conflict was adequate?
I suspect that if this case were going to turn on the waiver, there would need to be an evidentiary hearing to ascertain whether they understood the waiver, because I think that there probably were allegations sufficient to suggest that they didn't understand the waiver, at least with regard to how the case evolved over time. And so whether that waiver was effective throughout.
They did it in advance. Okay.
Yeah, and whether that was effective throughout would be something I think would probably need to be litigated.
What does the record indicate as far as the allegation as to what this defendant was advised of, whether or not to take the original plea offer or not?
It doesn't reveal anything. There isn't an allegation in Mr. DePriest's amended motion about whether counsel advised him to take it or not. Counsel might have advised him. Counsel might have also advised him, consistent with whatever his interest was at the time. For instance, he might have been thinking before preliminary hearing and suppression, hey, I'm not pleading guilty to anything because I think we can beat this. I think we can win the motion to suppress. So you go do that. You file
a
motion
to
suppress.
What you're implying is that the defendant should have had his own counsel to assert all these other issues that he didn't assert. I mean, he's relying on his lawyer to represent him. And all these allegations of bring this forward, that forward. He was relying on his lawyer to represent him.
And as far as I can tell from the amended motion, this attorney did represent Mr. DePriest's interests throughout. There's never an allegation that Mr. DePriest said, you know, at this earlier point, had I known X, Y, or Z, I would have said, you know, I don't want this attorney because there's a conflict. He's helping my sister. He's not helping me. I mean, for all we know from the allegations in this case, Mr. DePriest was dead set from the very beginning to do whatever he could to help his sister.
You're assuming that he could waive any conflict then?
Well, assuming that a conflict arose, because I don't know what his interests are, but if his interests, because they're not alleged in the motion.
Because certainly we've agreed there's some situations where you cannot waive a conflict.
Yeah, and don't get me wrong, I can hypothesize probably 100 different circumstances that came up. Okay, 100. I'm being arbitrary. I could hypothesize many circumstances that would arise or could arise, pardon me, that could lead to counsel having to give advice that is either going to hurt one or the other. What we don't have here is an illustration through an allegation of fact that this actually occurred. And while there could have been an actual conflict of interest, under Mickens versus Taylor, it can't merely be a theoretical division of loyalties, because I think we can all easily imagine a division of loyalties in this case. It has to be that counsel's performance fell short, that counsel either did something or failed to do something.
You're doing an excellent job of hypothesizing different issues that might have occurred or should have occurred or could have occurred, but we need to ensure the integrity of the process. If someone's going to plead guilty to a crime, it's going to send them to jail.
That's correct, Your Honor. And the way that we ensure the integrity of the process is by appointing counsel to talk with the defendant and the attorney who represented him and to ascertain where that conflict of interest adversely affected counsel's performance and plead those facts in the motion and then prove them. That's how we ensure that the system maintains its integrity, by making them allege facts showing that the system actually lost its integrity. Until that happens, the motion court was absolutely correct in saying that the allegations here merely hinted at potential conflicts. So yes, I ask this court to affirm what the motion court found, because it wasn't clearly erroneous in finding that the allegations in this case did not allege an actual conflict of interest that adversely affected counsel's performance. The court should ratify that. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'll just go over the points where I disagree with opposing counsel. First of all, it wasn't David's duty to decide that there was an actual conflict of interest. Under our ethical rules, it's the attorney's, not David's. The other thing is, counsel hypothesized that, well, maybe the attorney could have said, given David good advice and still been Natalie's attorney. No, that's the very situation addressed in LaFrance. The court in LaFrance found that you can't give advice to one client because you're automatically divulging confidential information about your other client's case. And it's impossible to discern, as the court said, how an attorney can advise one client give one client advice about the strength or weakness of his case without divulging information about the other client's case. That's why in LaFrance, an actual conflict of interest was found and the convictions were vacated. And
the state argues that even if there were allegations sufficient to raise the question of conflict, that there wasn't an allegation that the conflict resulted in defective performance in counsel's representation of David. Was there an allegation that did that, and if so, what was it?
Allowing the group guilty plea, choosing to litigate the suppression issue, which was in Natalie's favor and not David's, because it lost him the offer.
The record doesn't support that it was contingent, how does that work for you?
Read the guilty plea hearing transcript, because between counsel and the prosecutor, they make it very clear that it is a contingent offer. that David couldn't, that Natalie couldn't plead guilty with an offer from the state unless David pleaded blind.
That's the third
afterwards.
Offer.
I'm talking about at the plea at the very outset. What prohibited, prohibited David from accepting the original plea, which was the 10 years?
Okay. Your Honor is asking something that I'm going to find it difficult to answer. Both my colleague and I requested a copy or something of plea counsel's file. He sent separate files to each one of us. There was, in the batch that Natalie got, a letter from counsel that said, don't take that original offer. You, Natalie, don't take that original offer. And she made the allegation in her brief that David was also told, don't take that original offer. I did not get that letter in the batch I got. And because of that, I was not comfortable stating in the amended motion that David had been advised by plea counsel, don't take the original offer.
And the letter in the other one doesn't reference David.
That's my understanding that it.
So you were your cautious action.
Yes.
Was justified.
I wanted to make sure that whatever I said plea counsel said or did or thought or believed, I had a letter or I had a record to back it up. And I didn't have that letter, so I couldn't make that allegation. I didn't feel comfortable making that allegation.
But there was an allegation in Natalie's that the same was made to David.
Yes. Yes. The respondent's brief at 11. Thank you.
Was there an allegation in Natalie's motion?
I do not know. I have purposely not read Natalie's motion because of the conflict of interest.
Any other questions?
Oh, one more thing. Kyler versus Sullivan makes it very clear. In answer to the opposing counsel's hypothesizing, if you have an actual conflict of interest, that's the end of the discussion. Prejudice is presumed. It is both ineffective assistance of counsel and prejudicial where there's an actual conflict of interest.
It's structural error, in effect.
Yes. That's the end of the discussion.
Thank you. Your time is up.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Case will be submitted.
Good to see both counsel again.
Oh, okay.